All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW-2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. So we want to welcome you to our program. I'm really excited to have you here today. We're going to talk a little music and we're going to talk a little adventure during the program. The first part of the program, we're going to be talking with some guys from Operation Song. All of you who listen to Veterans Radio are familiar with Operation Song. And we've got a great story to tell today. And we've got the person who has the story, and then the guy who helped him record the story, and then we're going to play the song that they were able to put together. So I'm excited for that. The second part of the program is going to be about a Coast Guard rescue of the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis. And this was a Coast Guard ship that got stuck up in Alaska in the Aleutians during a storm where the boat went over almost 60 degrees. It's a great story. And the book is titled All Present and Accounted For. It's by Captain Stephen Craig. And so Captain Craig is going to be all along with two crewmen from the Jarvis who's going to be kind of filling us into what really happened. But before we get into that, I have to really say, thank you to all of our sponsors and all of you supporters out there that help us keep on the air every single week here on Veterans Radio on our stations, WAAM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WDDK in Detroit, Michigan, KMET out in California, and KFOW in Minnesota. So we want to thank everybody that does help us do that. And starting at the top of the list, I guess you could say our corporate sponsors, our Legal Help for Veterans. And Legal Help for Veterans, they specialize in veteran disability claims. So give them a call at 800-693-4800. You know, with this new PACT Act, there's all kinds of new benefits that are available and lots of questions that need to be answered. So you could give Legal Help a call. That number, again, is 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of a veteran-owned business. For more information, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. A quick reminder here is if you want to do business with the federal government and you are a veteran-owned business, you need to be certified that you are really a veteran-owned business. And so these are the guys that can help you do that. That's nvbdc.org. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information about the VA center here, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to thank our local veterans organizations for their longtime support. We've been doing this for almost 20 years, and we could never do it without the help of the Irwin Prescorn American Legion Post number 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. So, all right, here we go. So we're going to go right into our story. And joining me right now here on Veterans Radio, we've got two gentlemen who are really talented gentlemen. Number one is George Meldrum, and George is a Vietnam veteran, and it's his story that we're going to be talking about. So, George, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And Chuck Jones, not the Chuck Jones of Looney Tunes, the Chuck Jones, a musician who lives in Nashville and helped George put his story together. So, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Dale. Pleasure to be here, man.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Operation Song does and how it operates?
Absolutely. It all started about 10 years ago. A buddy of mine, who's another professional songwriter here in Nashville, Bob Regan, he started it and basically as a, just a labor of love. He was retiring from songwriting professionally at that point in time and just put his heart and soul into helping veterans, as they say, as one song at a time, as their motto is. And Bob started the company, and he would just call his buddies who were professional songwriters here in town that he'd known through the years. And he also got a hold of the Veterans Hospital here in town and one down in Chattanooga. I think he started out kind of small. And he would send writers out to write with veterans on a regular basis, like once a week or something like that. And then at some point he started doing retreats, these in-person retreats where, he's done them all over the country now, but they would hold them here in Nashville, down in Georgia, Fort Benning, places like that. But I've done several of these live retreats, and that's where they just basically would have like maybe 10 to 15 veterans and about the same amount of songwriters. And what it is, it's a lot of these veterans come back and say that this experience for them helped them as much as any therapy they ever had, if not more, And it's just very healing for a lot of them, to sit and be able to tell their story to somebody and someone who can, basically take those, their words and kind of meld them into a song, And a lot of times there might be two songwriters with a veteran, or maybe it's just one-on-one. But anyway, the whole point of the deal is to take the veteran's story and put it to song and then record it for them. And so they'll have it, And very few of them are musically inclined, musically inclined. Every now and then someone like George will come along who can actually sing. And I think you're a drummer too, right, George? You were a musician when you went over to Vietnam. Is that right?
That's correct. I was a drummer.
That's what I thought. And so, every
now and then.
Yeah. But so that's the point, is just to dive in, and basically I'll sit there with a with a pencil and pad, and or these days an iPad, whatever, and just listen to them talk and ask some questions. And sometimes they don't even want to write about their experience in the service. They want to write about something entirely different. Some of them are pissed off at the service. Oh, I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't use certain language. So
all right, yes, with that one.
You can get away with that. Okay. So at any rate, I'll take, and most of the time, and this that's the case with this song that me and George wrote, Whiskey on Your Stone. The words that they say, they tell me in their story, I'll put those into the song. And, so they feel a part of they feel vested in it. It's their lyrics as much as mine. And, generally I'll come up with a melody and some chords on guitar, and, at the end of, I think me and George wrote this one, and I'm not sure if we had a whole day to do it. These days, most of the time I'm writing in 2 hours, wow, with the guys, but, Operation Song does a kind of a co-venture with Shepherd Center down in Atlanta that has the SHARE organization, and they work entirely with, I think they can get 20 veterans or active duty military in there at the same time. They give them apartments, and it's all of them have TBIs of some sort, And so I work with them quite a bit now, but it's a thing through Operation Song. But that's basically, I think this story, like I said, they just had a 10-year anniversary for Bob and the organization, and he no longer runs it. He is still involved. A veteran named Mike Byer actually runs it these days. And, but I think they've written that this to date over, I know it's over 1,000, maybe as many, I think it might be up to 1,500 or so songs now that they've written with veterans.
Yeah, we have had Operation Song on Veterans Radio before because of the great work that they're doing.
Yeah.
And there's another group out in Wisconsin, I think, that does something similar. I think it's called Warrior Songs. And but I wanted to get to George because I want to hear his story. And then, we're going to hear George's story, and then we're going to play the song that George and Chuck put together. So, George, tell me, we talked just briefly before we went on the air. So you were in Vietnam at the end of 1968 into 69, and you were with what outfit?
1st Infantry Division.
Big Red One, right?
Yeah, if you're going to be one, be a Big Red One. I was with the 2nd of the 28th Infantry. We were Black Lions, and we worked out of Lycay on Highway 13, as you're familiar with. We did just a lot of S&D, a lot of walking, a lot of hopping, all day long, that was pretty much what we did.
You mentioned earlier that the first day that you got there, they were smart enough to put you out near the point.
Yeah, they let me experience the jungle. The full force of the jungle, if you will. They gave me that machete and said, go for it. And at the time, what we would do, we would walk in three files, and you never walk on a, you never walk on a trail, you know, because that's suicide to walk on a trail. They just ambush you that way. So you walk through the jungle and you just make your own way. And, it's quite an experience for those that, have been in a forest. It's not really the same thing. The jungle is like, just a mesh. Before you, and you have to push and cut your way through. It's a different experience.
How old were you when you went to Vietnam?
I was 19 years old.
Okay.
When I went to Vietnam, I was just turned 19 or just turned 20. I know because let's see, 68 and, September, so that would have been an even. Yeah, I was 20. I was 20, just turned 20.
So tell me about the story of your song, this Whiskey on Your Stone. Can you tell me what that came about?
The song deals with, to me, and a lot of guys, struggle with, survivor's remorse, and you're the guy that made it, and maybe the next guy next to you or the person just up the file from you, just happens to be in the spot where he gets killed and you don't, and you wonder, you know, why wasn't it me? And you struggle with that. In this particular case, a guy named OB, everybody has their nicknames. In fact, most of the guys, I don't even know their names. I don't remember their name, but OB was a kid named James O'Banion. We had a guy named Caldwell, which was Will. I was Mel, and we had, Flash and Maddie and Guinea and Wop. And these two guys were very proud of being, Italian Americans, and they picked their own names. There were their own nicknames, but everybody had a nickname. And OB and I were on an operation together. I had just come back. I had just come back from R&R, and I at the time was carrying a 60, and I had given my 60 to my ammo bear. And when I got back to the field, he asked me, "Did I want it back?" And I said, "No, you just hold on to it until we get done with this operation, and then I'll take it back." And he's another guy that was killed that same day. And so that fueled that helped to fuel the same, you know, survivor's remorse. So it talks about, the song talks about, a guy that, he talks to his buddy, and you're not sure how he's talking to his buddy, but, during the song, you get the idea that he talks to him when he visits his grave. So that's basically what the song is about.
I mean, obviously, it's a very personal song for you, and the story. And you know, as you mentioned before, there are so many veterans from all kinds of generations and conflicts and so forth that have that survivor's remorse because they turned left instead of turning right, and you know their buddy, you know, got it.
Yeah, and he did guilty. You know, like it should have been me. Well, of course, it should never have been anyone.
Oh, right, but, right. Well, I think this is a great thing that Operation Song is doing, and I want our audience to hear this song. And,
well, I must say, I feel really blessed, very lucky that I got Chuck. Was the one that I got to write this with, because what a talented musician and songwriter he is, and it really really made the song.
Well, thank you, George. I appreciate that, buddy.
I think our audience is going to really enjoy the song, and also you cannot miss the message, and it sounds like it's professional. This is actually George Meldrum is doing the vocal on this version. So as soon as I can get...
It's Chuck doing the harmony. And it's Chuck's harmony.
He's in the background, right? There. Okay. So we're going to go to the song. The song is entitled Whiskey on Your Stone. And so, Derek, whenever you're ready, we're going to be playing the number 4 version of it.
Remember when we landed? It was humid, it was hot. 4-day operation, we were walking point a lot. Humping through that jungle, how thirsty it got. Man, do you remember? Remember when we'd stop, set up for the night? Spread out in a circle, hope the moon don't get too bright. Praying it don't rain, just waiting for the light. Man, do you remember? Been a while now since I talked to you about all the crazy times we had, all the hell that we walked through, the good, the ugly, and the bad. Can't share this stuff with no one else. I don't. So here I am again, pouring whiskey on your stone. Remember all the dreams we shared over coffee and some Spam? You were gonna drive for NASCAR, I'd be a music man. When we got back to the world, yeah, we sure had big plans. Man, do you remember? Oftentimes I think about the way that day went down. If I'd been standing where you were, I'd be laying in that ground. Oh, but that ain't how it happened, and there ain't no peace I found. And it hurts me to remember. Been a while now since I talked to you about all the crazy times we had, all the hell that we walked through, the good, the ugly, and the bad. Can't share this stuff with no one else. I don't like talking to myself. You know how much I hate to drink alone. So here I am again. Yeah, here I am again, pouring whiskey on your stone. Whiskey on your stone.
Oh, wow. That's all I can say. That's just a great song. That's great, George. You and Chuck certainly did put it together. I mean, I've listened to this song now probably 20 times over the last week.
Oh, wow.
Each time it just strikes nerve. You know, it's not that I didn't, you know, like I said, everybody that was over there or in any conflict probably has had the example of being near somebody that got killed, and you know, it could have been you just as easily. And so I want to thank both of you for the story, for the song, and I really want to thank Operation Song for what they're doing for veterans.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, and yep. Help them get their stories out, because as George mentioned earlier on, you know, sometimes we can talk about these things, but then sometimes we just shut down. And Chuck obviously did a good job of pulling this out of George and then putting it to just a beautiful melody, I thought.
Well, thank you guys, man. It's always an honor to do it.
Well,
thank you, Chuck.
You bet, buddy.
Well, yeah, thank you enough.
Thanks both of you guys for being on Veterans Radio today. And I encourage our audience to go to operationsong.org. And there are many songs that are listed there, and you can purchase albums and you can see how the process works, and you know, maybe you can bring it into your own hometown, wherever you happen to be there, you know, where they could do something like this. It's such a great program that,
yeah, really.
You know, we're anxious to have Operation Song back on again, you know, next month or a couple of months out down the road. And again, for our listeners, you can go to veteransradio.net, type in Operation Song, and you'll see that we've had them on a couple of times before. There's a lot of their songs are on YouTube too. They have their own channel.
And Bandcamp, they have it on Bandcamp. I didn't know they had a YouTube channel, but I'll have to check that out. You know, I don't doubt it. You know.
On their website.
On the website. I got you. Yeah.
All right. So thank you both very much for being on the program, and we hope to have you back again. If you come up with another story, George, let us know. I'd be happy to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you, George. Thanks
for having us. Hey, yeah, good to see you too, Chuck. Always a pleasure. You're great.
Back at you.
We are going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to the Coast Guard. So you're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Army Captain Ed Freeman flew 14 rescue missions under intense enemy fire, saving 30 seriously wounded soldiers. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
As a flight leader, Freeman supported a heavily engaged American infantry battalion in the I Trang Valley in the Republic of Vietnam. The unit was almost out of ammunition after taking some of the heaviest casualties of the war, fighting off a relentless attack from a highly motivated, heavily armed enemy force. When the infantry commander closed the helicopter landing zone due to intense direct enemy fire, Freeman risked his own life by flying his unarmed helicopter through a gauntlet of enemy fire time after time, delivering critically needed ammunition, water, and medical supplies to the besieged battalion. His flights had a direct impact on the battle's outcome by providing the engaged units with timely supplies of ammunition critical to their survival. After medical evacuation helicopters refused to fly into the area due to intense enemy fire, Captain Freeman flew 14 separate rescue missions, providing life-saving evacuation of an estimated 30 seriously wounded soldiers, some of whom would not have survived had he not acted. All flights were made into a small emergency landing zone within 100 to 200 yards of the defensive perimeter, where heavily committed units were perilously holding off the attacking elements.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio. And just a quick reminder that the gentlemen that were on in the first portion of the program were from Operation Song. And I just love that group because what they do is they take veteran stories and turn them into professionally recorded music. And so I encourage you to go to their website. That's operationsong.org and see what they can do. Maybe you've got a good story that you might be interested in. So we're going to kind of do a little quick transition here from songwriting to the Coast Guard. And I want to introduce the Coast Guard first. So we're going to just play a brief little segment of their theme. So, Derek, hit it. All right, Semper Paratus. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. Joining me on the line right now, actually, are going to be three people. We're going to start off with the author of the book first. The author, the story is All Present and Accounted For. That's the title of the book. And the first guest is Captain Stephen Craig. He's United States Coast Guard Reserve, retired. And he wrote the story of the grounding of the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis. So, Steve, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, glad you could have me on. Thanks.
It's a pleasure to have you on. This story I found amazing and scary and redeeming and all the other good positive words I can think of as we go along. What made you decide to write this story?
Well, back in 1973, I was stationed over at base Honolulu, and I ran across one of the crew members from the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis. They had that incident in November of 1972, and this was about 6 months later, and I ran across this guy. He's telling me a story about the ship almost sinking and talk about having, they were had prayer circles because they thought they were going to die and they were praying for their safe rescue. And anyway, the story stuck with me because first I was sort of dumbfounded because I'd never heard of this story. And you know, I'd been around the base there. Jarvis was home base out of Honolulu and I hadn't heard the story. So the story stuck with me. And then, 2018, I was working as a contractor for FEMA, doing emergency management type of work, planning, and I retired from all that, and I thought, well, you know, I think I'll write a magazine article about this story, and the more I researched, it just sort of exploded. I interviewed over 35 former crew members. I interviewed people that are associated with the air assets as far as dropping supplies, people at various stations throughout the Coast Guard. And then I also got the records from San Bruno, the official ship logs. And so I took the stories, and then I basically outlined the dates and times that were in the ship logs and then matched the stories up to the timelines. And that's how I came out with the book. First part of the book is, I think you know, is in regard to David Jarvis, who the ship was named after. He was quite infamous in the Coast Guard, first the Reagan Cutter Service, and most notably the rescue of 1897 of some 8 trapped ships up in northern Alaska, trapped in the ice. And there was expedition to rescue. There was 265 men up there, and David Jarvis led the effort to go up and rescue. And just that part of it was just amazing that they had to trek like 1,600 miles to get to the trapped whalers. They had to go overland. They sailed as far north as they could, and then they were dropped off and then go overland to rescue the trapped whalers. And these are conditions where it's about 100% dark the whole time. Temperatures drop down to minus 50 degrees. And you know, I reread my section yesterday, and the environmental conditions just extremely horrible. And it's just amazing they made it. And then when you read the story about the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis, the environmental conditions they had to deal with, because it was in November of 1972, and that's not the best time to be up in Alaska. And the conditions were just horrendous for them.
I can tell you, just reading the book, I was cold. Didn't make any difference.
Yeah.
Kept jacking the heat up because it was cold. So the history of the Coast Guard is kind of interesting in itself. And you do a really thorough job of giving us a background on the Coast Guard. And I have a personal interest in this because my dad was in the Coast Guard during World War II. And, he ended up in the Pacific and kamikazes and the whole bit. And, so I can really empathize. The Coast Guard actually started out doing what? What was their main function when they were first founded?
Jack Hunter's on the phone. Probably has a better answer than I do. I believe that one of the main purposes at first was like preventing pirates from taking over ships. We had different names over the years. When 1915, the U.S. Revenue Cutter Service, which is what it was when David Jarvis was in, was then merged with another life-saving service, and that formed the U.S. Coast Guard in 1915. Okay. David Jarvis is quite, even today, they have a leadership inspirational award that's called the David Jarvis Award that's awarded annually for leadership.
Well, that certainly is understandable. You know, the audience, and we're talking right now with Steve Gregg, and he wrote a book that is titled All Present and Accounted For, which is the story of the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis in November of 72. And he's included in the book the story of Jarvis going overland to rescue these people in Alaska. And it's just a harrowing story. I mean, it's almost as harrowing as the story about the ship itself. So the Jarvis was, when was the Jarvis commissioned?
It was, the kit was laid in 1971, and then it was home ported in 1972 out of Honolulu. And, it one of their first missions later in the year, in November or October, was to go up to Alaska and help enforce the fisheries, treaties and make sure those, fishing vessels were in compliance. They did some other maritime activities up there as well, as far as research. So that was in November 1972 when they had that incident. But yeah, they were the Coast Guard's newest ship, the Pride of Sleep, as you could say.
How big is a Coast Guard cutter? I never, you know, the only Coast Guard ships I've seen have been on the Great Lakes.
Yeah, the high Dirtsker is what Jarvis was, and they're 378 feet long. I think there was 11 of them that were commissioned, but none are in existence today or in the U.S. forces. A lot of them were sold to foreign countries. The cutter Jarvis was given to the country of Bangladesh, other countries. The Philippines got a few of our vessels as well. The same thing with some of the buoy tenders. A lot of them were either, mothballed or sold for scrap. So a lot of the ships that we had in the 70s are no longer around.
They modernized.
Or at least they're employed with other countries.
All right. We've got two other people on the line that actually were on the ship during this adventure, put it that way. Jack Hunter. Jack, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. So where were you on the ship, and were you with the ship right after it was commissioned?
Yes, we were part of the pre-commissioning crew in 1971, and the ship, we went aboard the end of December of 1971 in New Orleans, and we commissioned it in full operation in August the 4th of 1972. So this Alaska Patrol was actually our second patrol. In 1972, we'd done a weather station back before we had all the satellites. We had ships stationed around the world at different locations in the open ocean. It was halfway between Hawaii and San Francisco, and that's where the ocean station was. But this particular one was we left in October, and we went to Alaska for, as Stephen said, for our fish patrol, which, I went to many more after that date, but I was the chief gunner's mate at the time on the Jarvis, and I did end up spending 4 years as part of that crew. I was the last one of the original crew to depart. I departed in 1975, so I was there about 4 years.
Okay, and I've got Richard Brunk, is it? Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dale, and good to hear from you again, Steve.
Yeah, it's all right. It's old home week for you folks, which is good. So tell me what your relationship was to the Jarvis.
Well, I boarded the Jarvis when it came to Honolulu. The day it came in, I was on previously the Coast Guard cutter Chautauqua, which was home based in Honolulu. We decommissioned that and took it to Portsmouth, Virginia, which was given to the Vietnamese. And then I was flown back. I was 18 at the time. I just graduated high school. And as many people during that time, it was either college or the military. And I chose the military, and the Coast Guard was it. So So when the Jarvis came to Honolulu, I came on the day she pulled in and was on there for all the workups to go through our patrols and on there when it its patrol up in Alaska.
So what was your specialty?
I came on as a seaman, and I made BM3, Bosun Mate Third Class, which is an E4 on the Jarvis. And pretty much that's the jack of all trades, master of none. We pretty much did everything topside, gunnery, defense, weapons, painting, maintenance, drove the ship. You name it, we did it. We just didn't work on the engines, ran the small boat. So we were involved in pretty much everything topside.
Okay. All right. So you guys were all over the place. I'm just sitting here thinking, wondering where this story is going to go, because I know what's going to happen next. And I'm anxious to hear both your and Jack's reactions to when Steve tells us what happened to the Jarvis. So I'm going to go back to you, Steve. We're talking, as I mentioned before, here on Veterans Radio with Captain Steve Craig. He's a United States Coast Guard Reserve retired. His book is titled All President Accounted For, the 1972 Alaska Grounding of the U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Jarvis and the efforts that were made to save the ship. So, Stephen, take us to November 1972, and what in the heck happened?
Well, they had encountered, as the day went on, they had a crew member had to get some dental work done up there near Dutch Harbor. And they had gone ashore, and when they came back, the wind started picking up. They had anchored, and the captain had been like awake for 30 hours because of the weather getting worse, and he had gone to sleep. They had anchored. There was a new ensign that was on the ship. They had given some of the other officers time off because they wanted them available the next day when they would be underway. And he told the ensign that, look, if something happens, you wake me up right away. And lo and behold, the winds picked up. A new term I learned interviewing people was a willowall, that is like a severe wind that comes down through the mountain pass can actually create a lot of havoc. Go on YouTube and Google willowall. There's some videos out there and give you an idea of what it was. And a couple of people felt like it was a willowall. It definitely had hit the ship. Anyway, the ship dragged anchor, and it went aground. And right before it went aground, the captain came up, and it was unfortunately too late to do much about it at that time. But it went aground. It tore not a real big hole, but it tore a hole, and they were filling up with hundreds of gallons of water in the engine room. They got it patched, and they proceeded. There was discussion with some of the people, officers and warrant officers, on whether they should go out or not the next day. And this was the day before satellites. There was no way you could figure out what the weather was going to be like. So they headed out to sea the next day. The decision was made they could make it. Captain assured the district that they were fine to sail out. And as they were sailing out, the XO had mentioned he had written a long story about it, and the most monstrous seas that he had ever seen hit the ship. They went out in just extremely bad weather. And, of course, the engine room, it tore the shoring off. It filled up the engine room with, I believe, about 11, 12 feet of water, disabled the engines, and they were thus, adrift in the water. And one of the harrowing stories was that it was blinding out. You had snow and ice and rain and all that, and it was dark out. And the captain decided they were going to go ahead and head back to where they had anchored to get out of the high seas. And as he turned, he couldn't see anything. Pitch black, and a wave hit him. And it actually put the ship at like a 60-degree angle. And several crew members mentioned how they, one time they're walking on the deck, next thing you know, they're walking on the bulkhead, wondering what the heck was going on. And they had some other severe waves after that as well. I had one person tell me that was impossible for a ship to hit a 60-degree angle like that. But it's in the official records, I believe, back east. I believe Runke had some information on that. But anyway, so they went adrift. They lost all power, and they were heading toward Akutan Island. And if they hit the rocks, they would definitely they would sink. It'd tear the ship apart. There was some discussion about having the life boats lowered, and guys would try to make it to shore with that. And Runke had some interesting comments. He figured he'd rather go down with the ship than getting those life rafts, especially when you got waves that are 20, 30, you know, 40 feet high. There's no way a life craft could possibly even make it. You'd be thrown in water, and November water in Alaska, you'd be freezing up immediately and die in those waters. So they sent out an SOS. A friend of mine was on a Lorenz station up there in Alaska, and he was coming on watch. And he said, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, the Jarvis sent out SOS, so we're dealing with that right now." And he said, "Well, so what ship's in danger?" And the guy said, "You don't understand." He says, "It's the Jarvis that's in danger." And so it's a bad situation. Newspapers all over the world were reporting progress. There's four or five newspapers, including one television story that came out and said the ship had actually sunk. So Coast Guard had to do a lot of damage control on that story, say, no, the ship is not sunk. You know, they're proceeding for rescue. A Japanese trawler did come upon the scene. Meantime, the crew, they had tried different maneuvers to slow the ship down, because I believe the trawler said, "Well, yeah, we could be there in about an hour." And I think the ship officers figured, "Well, we're going to go aground in a half hour, so that's not good enough." So they did a bunch of maneuvers to try to slow the ship down, and you know, the rest is history. Obviously the trawler got on scene, and Jack Hunter was instrumental in firing the tow gun over to the ship. In conditions that I can't imagine, he was, you know, on his knees, and the ship's rocking back and forth, and trying to fire that gun. And he'll have more story on that. But yeah, like the rest of history, they were towed Dutch Harbor, where they underwent some repairs. Navy divers came in, did some underground water welding, and put temporary patches on the ship for them to proceed.
I'm still thinking about the idea of a ship rolling 60 degrees or walking on the bulkheads. Jack, what was it like for you? I mean, with 40 and 50 foot waves, and of course the weather was, you know, what, zero?
Yeah, it was probably, I don't know the temperature, to be honest with you. I know it was cold. It was very, very cold, and I wasn't as prepared as Brocky would be. He was on deck working, and I had my own problems in the projectile magazine, which also had a leak. We'd punched a hole, not a hole, but we experienced a leak in the projectile magazine, so we were flooding in that compartment also. And so, being a gunner's mate, that was my responsibility, that area. But when the Japanese trawler came, we had to pass a line from us to them, and they attempted to fire their line from them to us, and they used rockets, like a fireworks type rocket to fire to us.
Okay.
And both of those lines that they fired all flew high, and they ended up in our radar antennas up above. And so I fired what we call a line throwing gun, which is a projectile that's attached to a line to allow you to pass line from ship to ship. And of course, they had one language and we had another. And it was very difficult for them to understand what we wanted, so we had a tug of war at the time to reattach my line from the line torn gun to the messenger, which we were sending to them. The messenger is a line, that a smaller line to allow you to pull bigger lines back and forth. And so it was very cold. We were on the forecastle, which is the bow of the ship. And like Stephen said, I was on my knees because the wind was blowing, the ship was rocking and rolling. And it was extremely cold, and I'd been out there for 30 or 40 minutes, and again, unprepared, no real foul weather gear for me. But anyway, I got braced enough, being on your knees, and fired a gun, and the line was passed, and we were able to connect our towing line to them so they could proceed to tow us. So that was the my contribution to that part of it. But the deck force that Brocky was on, they moved all the towing lines from the stern to the bow, because we normally do the towing, not being towed. So our towing lines were stowed in the after part of the ship, and so that was a big undertaking in itself, just to move that line from the aft to the stern, and that was done in preparation for this towing operation.
Oh, okay. Richard, where were you at the time?
Well, at the time of the initial grounding, it was in the morning. I was in the rack, and we heard the ship scrape bottom, and we didn't know what was going on, but we knew it wasn't good because the berthing area I was in, a 30-man berthing area, was below the water line. So we all jumped out of the rack and put our clothes on. We were running out of the berthing area, and then the battle stations went off. And I was part of the gunnery crew. We had a 5-inch 38 mount, which Chief Hunter was in charge in. And once we all mustered, and we were present and accounted for, we all went to the mess deck, and they were using people to help the engineers. Well, as the ship, as they stated, left the next day, I mean, you could really see the mountainous seas. We were in the lee of the Aleutian Chain, and you could see the really rough seas out there. And once we hit the rough seas, pretty much all hell broke loose, and, you know, we were responding from one emergency to the other. We started taking out water, and as Steve said, the Coast Guard sent out, or the Jarvis sent out an SOS, and the Air Station Kodiak started sending out aircraft with pumps to drop to us. And this was in the middle of the night. We had no lights. We had no power. And they were flying so low, Dale, that I swear to God, I thought they were going to hit the mast, the top of the mast. And they were dropping these pumps because they had hit the flight deck. Because
right.
If they hit the water, we couldn't retrieve them.
You had a helicopter on board the ship, correct?
Yes. The aircraft came after the helicopter took off. That is correct.
Okay.
Right after the helicopter launched off, which was another very dangerous evolution. I mean, that thing took off like a spring.
I was going to say, it had to be quite the takeoff off of a
It was a one-time deal, because from what I recall, I heard that the captain said, you guys got one shot. If it doesn't work, we're pushing it over the side because we had too much topside weight. And we couldn't get any of the pumps because they all went in the water and we couldn't retrieve them with our small boats. So, I had no idea we were drifting so close to the island, to be perfectly honest with you. But getting, as Jack said, getting the tow line up forward with the ship rocking and rolling, it was icy and rainy. You could not walk. You were just sliding from side to side, hanging on to whatever you could. And it just amazes me that nobody fell overside or nobody was lost. And I really didn't realize how much danger we were in until many, many years later. You know, I was 18 years old. I was young and indestructible, and I became an officer, and I was going to be the executive officer of a buoy tender in San Francisco. So I went to prospective commanding officers and executive officer school at the academy, and they used the Jarvis grounding as the case study for stability. And that's when I realized how much danger we were really, really in that the ship had exceeded the design rolls for capsizing, which I'm very, very thankful the engineers were off on the high side.
Nobody slid off the ship after reading it. The book is titled, It's All Present and Accounted For. I'm going to go back to the author, Steve, right now. Wow. Where was the Coast Guard? They couldn't get to it in time, or what was going on?
They didn't have any assets that were nearby. I think, I don't think there was any other high endurance cutters nearby. Maybe some buoy tenders, but the closest ships were the Japanese trawlers. There was two of them that were somewhat close, but as far as any other ships, they were on their own.
I think the book talks about the indomitable spirit of the crew and their devotion to saving their ship. Could you address that a little bit? Because that's a big part of the story.
I heard from several of the crew members said they didn't have time to really have fear. They were too busy working to save the ship to even stop and think about it. A couple of crew members that were up on the bridge, one of them was, he looked over in the corner and a crew member was basically, curled up, yeah, worried that they were going to die. And he immediately, got a hold of the guy and knocked some sense at them and said, hey, you got to get busy. Here, you need to do this, And it was, and the captain had the same feeling that he had to keep the crew busy so they wouldn't dwell on things. I know Jack was, they had this water pail brigade where they would take water and up the ladder and then toss it overboard, and people got soaked doing that. But the captain wanted to make sure that everybody was keeping busy so they wouldn't stop and think about how dire it was. Captain had quite a background. He had been in the Marine Service, Merchant Marine Service during World War II, and he had quite a background. And the reason he came up with Coast Guard was he had spent about 10 years in the Merchant Marines and came home one day and his daughter went screaming away from him to her mom saying, who's that strange man in the house? And so he decided, I think I'm done with this. And he selected for the Coast Guard and he had quite a background, and he sort of a natural choice to be the first commanding officer for the Jarvis based on a lot of his maritime experience. Wow. But he was, people I talked to said that crew members didn't really have time to think about dying. They were too busy doing their jobs. They were very well trained. That was one thing. Captain and the XO made sure that the crew members were very well trained before they left Honolulu. They did underway drills and they had won some awards. So that in itself may have helped save the ship. Also, I think a lot of credit goes to the chiefs. The chiefs were extremely experienced. He had great leadership, not only Jack Hunter, but Chief Stanswick was in charge of both mates. Rick worked under Stanswick. He's quite a colorful character. He's still around. He's in his 80s down in Florida, and I called him. Somebody told me, yeah, if you call him, you're going to need an hour, and I did. But, he started telling me a story. He says, Steve, I'll tell you this story, but he said, you can't put it in the book. And he'd tell me a story. I'm thinking, yeah, that's not going in the book. But crew members loved him. If they had to work late, he made sure, they worked late, but he was there right there working with them. And it was one thing. He was quite a leader.
We're running up against the clock, and it's just like you said, this story is, there's so much more to it. And I want to thank all three of you for joining us and just, telling us what in the world this whole thing was about. This is a Coast Guard cutter. I didn't know that they had 370 foot long ships and that they would get stuck up in the Aleutian Islands in a raging storm with 30 and 40 foot waves and below zero temperatures and everything else. And that they didn't lose anybody. That's what I thought was incredible, not losing anybody, and the whole thing is flooded and the septic system is floating, everything is floating all over the ship and they didn't have fresh water. I'm encouraging our audience, you got to go out and read this story. You just have to read it. The book is called All Present and Accounted For. The writer is Stephen Craig. It's on Amazon. I think you have your own website, don't you, Steve?
Yeah, it's Stephen J. Craig. Books.com.
And I understand that people can get an autographed copy if they order it through you.
Yeah, if they go to my email, it's scraig7002@gmail.com. I normally lot of the stuff goes through PayPal, so it's, you know, good, safe, secure. And they'll get an autographed copy. And if I send media rate, it's only $5 for shipping.
Okay. Well, I have to tell our audience that Steve has been after me for a couple of months to get him on the program, and I'm so grateful that you were so persistent. And I want to thank...
This is more work than writing the book as far as marketing.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're doing most of the marketing yourself.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, we'd be happy to we'd be happy to spread the word if you and if we get the opportunity to bring you back onto the program, I would love to do that. I want to thank Jack Hunter and Richard Brokey. Am I pronouncing your name right, Richard? I lost him. Okay. Well, we got to go. So, want to thank everybody for tuning in today and listening to Veterans Radio. I mentioned before at the beginning of the program we had Operation Song on. The last half of the program was All President Accounted For, the story of the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis. We had crew members and everything. It's a harrowing story. You got to read this thing. You never want to go out on a boat again. At least not me. So we're going to be back next week. We encourage you all to come on back. Jim Falzone will be the host next week. We've coming up programs. We've got our benefits program at the end of the month. So we need you to send us the questions of what you want to know about the PACTAC. So we got to go. I'm getting a signal. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry for Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.